At the UN today, world leaders gather to talk climate change. The UN Secretary General's guest list was invite only. Many big polluters didn't make the cut.
We must make up time lost to foot dragging, arm twisting, and the naked greed of entrenched interests raking in billions from fossil fuels.
Also on the program, Morocco's Atlas Mountains are home to picturesque adobe homes perched on cliffs. After the recent earthquake, the damage is all-encompassing.
Totally destroyed.
Plus, in Saskatchewan, new policies around student pronouns and parental involvement are stirring up debate. Some teachers simply are not on board with it.
I would have, extreme difficulty implementing the policy.
I'm Carol Hills. It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. At the United Nations today, Secretary General Antonio Guterres leaned on world leaders to close a huge gap between what's being done and what needs to be done to tackle climate change.
Humanity has opened the gates of hell.
But the future is not fixed. It's for leaders like you to write, Guterres went on to say. At the UN Climate Ambition Summit, the Secretary General placed a particular focus on phasing out fossil fuels.
The move from fossil fuels to renewables is happening, but we are decades behind. We must make up time lost to foot dragging, arm twisting, and the naked greed of entrenched interests raking in billions from fossil fuels.
The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler was in the room during the summit at the UN in New York today, and she joins us now from the media tent there. Carolyn, I understand this event was invite only for world leaders. Who all was there? I mean, who got the invite?
Carol, I think what's most notable about today isn't who is here, but who is not. Some 100 nations wanted to speak, but only about a third of them got to. The Secretary General wanted to reserve speaking slots for those with new or updated plans to move faster on climate change. And here's how that worked out. None of the three biggest emitters were here. China, U.S., and India. Together, they make up about 43% of emissions. And only five countries from the G20, the richest 20 countries, were represented here: Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, and South Africa. So the countries most responsible for climate change were not here, and that is saying something.
It sure is, and I'm sure that didn't go unnoticed by the countries who were there.
It definitely was noticed and noted upon here. The president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, said through an interpreter during his remarks at the summit that, yeah, we should stop exporting oil, but we're not the major problem here.
We are major chimneys, but the really big chimneys are China, India, the United States, and the European Union. Those chimneys need to be extinguished.
So the absence of those big players was certainly notable. Going into this event, the Secretary General had a special focus on fossil fuels for this meeting. Was there any news on that front?
Well, it does feel at the UN like there's finally this laser focus on the primary driver of climate change, of fossil fuels. You know, there was this call from protesters at these huge climate marches here in New York and around the world over the weekend to phase out fossil fuels. And California Governor Gavin Newsom, who was invited to speak at this summit today, even though President Biden was not, got the biggest applause line of the morning when he put a very fine point on the link between fossil fuels and climate change.
I think it's time for us to be a lot more clear. This climate crisis is a fossil fuel crisis. This climate crisis persists. It's not complicated.
And yet, to answer your question, Carol, you know, the Secretary General ahead of this summit called on, you know, a bunch of new commitments from countries on committing to no new coal, oil and gas, phasing out fossil fuels. And there wasn't very much news on that front today. Romania did commit to phasing out coal power by 2030. And yesterday, Colombia signed on to a Powering Past Coal alliance. But what I heard today from the UN floor was mostly a resharing of existing goals and kind of kicking the can down the road on this issue to the UN COP summit in Dubai in November. That's what Germany's Olaf Scholz did when he mentioned his country's deadline for phasing out coal.
Germany's own phase out by 2038, ideally by 2030, is firmly anchored in our law. But in Dubai, it will take the strong resolution of us all to phase out fossil fuels first and foremost coal.
So this is really just solidifying that there's going to be a showdown, a big debate over whether countries can commit to phasing out or down fossil fuels in Dubai come November.
Carolyn, it's interesting because you could hear that edge of anger or even resentment in the Colombian president's voice when we heard him a few minutes ago. I mean, the big players didn't show up. Is that the general sentiment there?
You know, there is this acknowledgement that there's a huge chasm between what needs to be done and what is being done, even what countries are saying on paper that they're going to do with regards to delivering on the Paris Agreement. And there has been a big drop in optimism about how successful this UN climate process can be since that Paris Agreement was signed in 2015. I spoke to Johan Rockström about this. He's a climate scientist who heads the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and he's been to a lot of these climate talks. And he has a pretty dismal view of the process right now.
We're seeing no progress. Actually, on the contrary, we're actually regressing. And the Global Stocktake Report that just came out recently just shows what a complete failure it has been since the Paris Agreement, and that this legally binding framework, which has this voluntary basis with nations being allowed to basically create their own reports voluntarily, simply does not work, at least not so far. So there's a great and rising frustration.
I got to ask, I mean, how is the Secretary General viewed in this process? I mean, is he being applauded for holding this summit anyway today, or is he being seen as ineffective?
I think folks acknowledge that he is really highlighting and putting a major focus on climate change as a priority issue. And there's not a lot of faulting him because the UN doesn't have a lot of power here. They can coerce and give incentives and bring people together. But as Boholo Kanawendu, a former cabinet minister in Botswana and a UN climate advisor, told me, you know, it's not up to the UN what countries do.
That, of course, they rely on member states to do stuff. And what the UN does is advocacy and can try to hold member states accountable on their commitments and pledges. But at the end of the day, it's about member states to realize that they want to be part of this multilateral system that they have set.
And right now, you know, a lot of countries did not show up with the kinds of new ambitious pledges that the UN was asking for today.
The World's Carolyn Beeler reporting from the UN Climate Ambition Summit at the UN in New York today. Thanks so much, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Carol.
Meanwhile, at the UN Security Council meeting in New York, blunt words from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Світова більшість визнає правду про цю війну.
Zelensky accused Russia of committing a, quote, criminal and unprovoked attack on his nation, an attack that undermines all norms of war and violates the UN Charter. He called Russia a terrorist state, and Zelensky said Russia should lose its veto power as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. Fireworks began well before Ukraine's president spoke. The Russian ambassador to the UN protested the decision to allow Zelensky to speak first ahead of UN Security Council members. Russia's Vasily Nebenzia said the meeting was turning into a one-man stand-up show, a nod to Zelensky's past as a comedian. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also spoke to the council, reiterating that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is in clear violation of the United Nations Charter. Later this hour, more from the UN General Assembly and a look at the sidelines diplomacy between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The drug fentanyl has been a plague in the U.S. for more than a decade. A new UCLA study puts that in stark perspective. It found that since 2010, overdose deaths from fentanyl have increased 50-fold here in the U.S., and the spike has gotten much steeper over the past 5 years. That's because fentanyl is increasingly showing up in street drugs. Fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin, and according to the DEA, 2 milligrams of fentanyl is considered a lethal dose for most people. That's the equivalent to a few grains of salt. Reporter Sam Quiñones covers the drug trade. We called him up to walk us through the global supply chain. Sam, where do the raw materials for fentanyl come from at this point?
Mostly from China, and they come to Mexico. So it's that trade in ingredients that's not just for fentanyl, but also for methamphetamine as well, meaning just enormous quantities that seem to be produced down in Mexico. It's because of a very easy access, very little scrutiny of the shipping ports and Mexico City airport.
And are these precursor chemicals in China, are they being made legally and sold legally to Mexico? I mean, who in China is making them and who are they selling them to?
Well, China has developed a very robust chemical industry over the last 20 years. There's thousands of chemical companies in China. Initially, they were producing fentanyl and selling it on the web, on the internet and on the dark web, selling by the pound through the mail, an ounce, a two, half a kilo, whatever it was. It was very small. In 2019, Chinese government put a strict regulation on that, and they stopped doing that. But there was no regulation on these chemicals. So China stopped being a source of fentanyl, remained a source of chemicals going to the Mexican trafficking world. And that is when you saw the explosion of fentanyl to cover the country.
They get to Mexico. They go to labs at cartels. Then what are they turned into there?
Fentanyl. It's very easy. There's a chemical, 4-ANPP, which is essentially the only precursor you would need, the only chemical you might need. But it's not a hard drug to make, just as methamphetamine is not a hard drug to make. It does not require a huge amount of chemistry knowledge. And so what you've found out in Mexico is that there's many, many people now making it. And certain cartels, particularly according to the DEA, Los Chapitos, the sons of Chapo Guzman, have been major players. But you also see, I think, a lot of other smaller time folks getting into it because it's not hard to do. And there's now a body of knowledge down there on how to do it.
And is it at this point when they're laced into street drugs bound for the U.S., or does that happen once the fentanyl is in the U.S.?
It is exported as fentanyl in powder form to the United States. The other, increasingly in the last 5-6 years, is it is transformed or included in counterfeit pills that look like a Percocet or a Xanax bar or an Adderall or an oxycodone generic 30 milligram. And that trade has just exploded. In my book, The Least of Us, I interviewed a woman who was the first woman to traffic those drugs from Tijuana into San Diego. And she was trafficking. She was smuggling 1,000 at a time.
And where do these counterfeit pills end up? On the street, sold illegally, or do any of them end up in actual pharmacies and on drugstore shelves?
There's been good reporting by the LA Times that shows that fentanyl is showing up in some of the pharmaceutical drugs sold as pharmaceuticals in Mexico. But by and large, this is being sold by street vendors. It's being sold by people who advertise their drugs on social media apps, particularly Snapchat and others like that. It's really ending up in the street. And what's happening now is that across America, you are seeing people survive their first exposures to fentanyl, and now they're addicted.
What kind of cooperation is needed between Mexico and the U.S. to get on top of the fentanyl problem?
Seems to me, I would think it would be helpful if they had a president who was at least interested in this topic. On our side, I think we need to do something about how easy it is to buy assault weapons at stores for almost anybody who turns up and has a driver's license saying he's 18. You know, this is a major problem creating the drug supply in our country. When those guns go down to Mexico along with the ammunition, they are used by traffickers down in Mexico to war with each other, but also to ensure the impunity that they need to be able to produce the quantities of fentanyl and methamphetamine that we are seeing pour into this country in the last several years. Drugs, money, and guns are all part of the mix here.
That's journalist Sam Quiñones laying out the global connections of the U.S. fentanyl problem. His recent book is called The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Armenian separatists have agreed to a ceasefire with Azerbaijan a day after fighting ramped up. They've been battling over an Azerbaijani region called Nagorno-Karabakh. It's made up of mostly ethnic Armenian Christians, but it's surrounded on all sides by predominantly Muslim Azerbaijanis. The ceasefire was brokered by Russia and may avert a wider war, at least for now. Richard Girgozian is director of the Regional Studies Center think tank in Yerevan, Armenia. We reached him in New York. Richard Girgozian, the ceasefire comes one day after a so-called anti-terrorist operation by Azerbaijani forces left dozens of people dead and hundreds wounded. What was the shooting about?
Well, unfortunately, it was Azerbaijan's campaign to restore control over the Armenian-populated Nagorno-Karabakh region. This is very much a continuation of an earlier, much deadlier war back in 2020.
Now, remind our listeners who runs Nagorno-Karabakh at this point. I mean, who controls it?
Well, what's interesting is Nagorno-Karabakh has not been part of Azerbaijan since the collapse of the Soviet Union, with over three decades of rather impressive democratic credentials. And this is one aspect of this conflict where the Armenian population does not want to be under subordination of the rather authoritarian control of Azerbaijan. This is a freedom question. It's a fight for freedom, if you will.
But just to be clear, Nagorno-Karabakh is part of Azerbaijan's territory, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes. In fact, even Armenia recognized the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. However, there was always a caveat that the status of Nagorno-Karabakh, the rights of the ethnic Armenian population, would have to be protected and subject to their own negotiations. So it's both more simple, but also more complex than it seems.
They would prefer to be part of Armenia.
Or to be left alone completely in terms of its own self-declared independence.
Now, getting back to this latest round of fighting, who started it?
Well, as Azerbaijan admits, it not only started it, but it also comes in the wake of a nine-month siege, a blockade of the region, also initiated by Azerbaijan.
A ceasefire came into effect at 1 p.m. local time today. What are the terms?
Well, the good news is a ceasefire in and of itself is a welcome development. In other words, the need to return to diplomacy over force of arms is an imperative. However, under the terms of the rather one-sided ceasefire, which was actually imposed by the Russian peacekeepers on the ground, Armenia and the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh have agreed to disarm and demobilize. What I'm worried about is the absence of any real security guarantee.
In the meantime, do the 120,000 ethnic Armenians who live in Nagorno-Karabakh, do they just kind of go about their business and go to school and work? Are things kind of proceeding apace?
Well, I wish there was a degree of normalcy. It's the imposition of a siege, a medieval-style blockade since last December, that has triggered critical shortages of food staples, medicines, even gasoline, which meant there are no longer ambulances or fire trucks or trash collection. So normalcy has long departed from Nagorno-Karabakh. What worries me is the lack of deterrence, where the commitment to disarmament by itself is basically surrendering the last element of self-defense for the population. And I am quite worried that the outlook for renewed hostilities is the new normal.
Richard Girigosyan is director of the Regional Studies Center think tank in Yerevan, Armenia. He's been updating us on the fighting and the ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deep in the Atlas Mountains of Morocco, where the earthquake struck last week, the scale of the damage is becoming more clear. That means grieving for lives lost and taking account of the buildings shaken into rubble. Those include some historic and cultural sites. Abdellatif Aitmoubarak is a trekking guide in the town of Imlil. He takes hikers to the top of the tallest Atlas peak, Mount Toubkal, and he knows the area well. Abdellatif, what are you seeing there now?
At the moment, things are starting to go back to normal a little bit, and the government is touring the villages, checking which properties need to rebuild. It's going to be a long process, but that's what it is.
What are people there in need of most at this point?
Food, we have, medication, we have, but winter is coming soon, so we don't know yet how effective will be on people living in camps. It's going to be a long process.
The Berber and Amazigh people in the mountains, what have they been experiencing?
Well, it was a real shock for them because they never had this kind of disaster. For the Atlas Mountain, this is something completely new.
Abdellatif, describe the view of the Atlas Mountains. What makes this region so special?
We've got peaks, we've got beautiful hills, The Berber people are very hospitable, very friendly. Nature, fresh air. We have luxury places here. You know, everything for everyone.
Can you describe the damage?
The Berber villages have gone, really. Only a few Berber villages that remain, but I don't think people will be able to reside in them anymore.
You say they're gone. They've just been totally destroyed?
Totally destroyed.
Wow.
Everyone is homeless, in a camp. A typical Berber village is usually built with adobe, stone, mud, wood for roofing. Those that are built on cliffs. Things now are going to change. But I think they will insist on the architecture to keep the beauty of the building. And they're going to be much stronger now than they used to be.
You know this area well. You know these villages and you know the culture. Are there buildings with an important heritage that have been damaged as well?
Well, at the moment in the Atlas Mountain, we have a World Heritage Site called Chinmao. It's ruined.
Is it a kind of religious site? Describe it for us.
Yeah, Chinmao was a city in the 11th century, a city that belonged to a dynasty called the Almohads. The dynasty ended up in Seville. They're the ones behind the Alhambra.
What has it been like for you, a native of this area, taking this all in? I mean, you grew up there.
Well, it's a completely different, a new life.
Are you going to continue to take tourists on treks in the area, in the Atlas Mountains?
Yes. Yeah, we were working on new programs that involve camping, hiking and camping, probably looking into also glamping, you know, for people who want more comfort. But it's, it takes time, you know. I think people will still come to visit the Atlas Mountain because they want to see. They saw it before the earthquake and they want to see it after the earthquake.
Abdul Latif Ait Mubarak is a trekking guide in the Atlas Mountains. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, welcome.
You're listening to The World. Art Meakey was 5 years old in 1942. That's when the Canadian government removed his family from their farm and forced them into an internment camp.
I've gone back to that farm several times. Looked at the house that we lived in. We got there, it was all boarded up.
The modern case for Japanese reparations in Canada. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Earlier this hour, we heard from the climate summit that is dominating the United Nations General Assembly in New York today. Also at the UN, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He'll give his address on Friday. Today, a meeting with President Biden. Their first meeting since Netanyahu became Israel's prime minister again. A delayed, perhaps awkward meeting. With us to tell us why is Alon Pincus. He's a retired Israeli diplomat and a former advisor to Israeli prime ministers. Alon, first, let's set the scene. Benjamin Netanyahu's visit has been marked by protests outside the UN by Israelis and Jewish Americans upset at the judicial reforms in Israel. Was this expected?
Oh, yeah, it was expected. It was announced, and it's going to go on throughout today, tomorrow, Thursday, and ahead of Mr. Netanyahu's speech at the UN Friday morning in New York.
And remind us why they're protesting, for those of us who aren't keeping super close tabs on Israeli politics.
Mr. Netanyahu's, his government was sworn in late December, and by early January, he announced a judicial coup d'etat that is emptying Israeli democracy by severely weakening the judiciary, by amending with a simple majority six basic laws, which constitute a framework for a constitution. On top of that, over 220 laws that will change the electoral system. So these demonstrations have been going on for 37 weeks running. There are about 350,000 Israelis protesting every Saturday night.
President Biden has tried to distance himself from Netanyahu, the man, but not Netanyahu, the ally. In other words, he's keeping the prime minister at arm's length, but Israel close. What's the communication been like between the Biden administration and Netanyahu's camp?
Well, President Biden, to his credit, has warned Mr. Netanyahu privately and publicly not to proceed with this autocratic, anti-democratic legislation, that if any constitutional reform is needed, it needs to be done by consent with broad agreement on all sides in Israel. And that is the reason that for 9 months, Mr. Netanyahu, in an unprecedented way, has not been invited to the White House. And their meeting is taking place, in fact, in New York, in the context of the UN General Assembly. On top of that, Mr. Biden is demanding, or requesting rather, from Mr. Netanyahu, concrete and clear answers on the Palestinian issue as a prerequisite to any kind of the so-called Saudi deal between the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel. He's been asking Netanyahu for answers and not getting them. And going back to your original question, I think that's been impacting the quality of the relationship, even as allies.
You've mentioned this a couple times in our conversation, the fact that they're meeting on the sidelines of the UN rather than a White House visit. Do you think the lack of a sit down at the White House is, in fact, a snub?
Absolutely. This hasn't happened since the early 70s, since Golda Meir was prime minister. Israeli prime ministers have always been invited to the White House. The visit may not have occurred days or weeks into an Israeli prime minister's tenure, but it was always a few short months thereafter. And they know each other for years. So it's a known commodity. And I think this is more than a snub. This is President Biden, who, by the way, a few months ago, getting off Air Force One in North Carolina, was asked by a journalist, will you invite Mr. Netanyahu to the White House? And he immediately blurted out a very vocal no.
Do you think there's any chance Biden can get Netanyahu to back off from the proposed judicial reforms in Israel that have generated such controversy and protests as we're seeing at the UN today?
No, I do not. Mr. Netanyahu has his own legal complications. He's being indicted on 3 counts of corruption and bribery. He has an extreme right-wing coalition. He just can't back off this. Otherwise, he has no government.
Earlier, you mentioned the talk of normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. How do you think Biden might address this specifically with Netanyahu?
Well, he's going to demand those answers on the Palestinians as a prerequisite to any advance on the Saudi thing. But the Saudi issue is even more a bilateral American-Saudi thing, because the Saudis, reportedly at least, are asking for a full defense pact with the U.S., for a civilian nuclear reactor, for arms. And I don't know that Biden is happy to give that.
And Saudi Arabia was the country that initiated that whole thing. And is Israel on board pending U.S. support of it?
Yeah, but even the Saudis are asking or demanding that Israel make some concrete moves on the Palestinian issue as a condition to moving on. And while the Saudis may not care that much about the Palestinians, and they care much more about the goodies they may get from the U.S., I think that, between Israel and Saudi Arabia, there's no reason not to normalize relations. But in the context of this tripartite agreement, each side needs to make ends meet. And I just honestly, I fail to see how each can benefit from this in the immediate run. Is it still doable? Yes. Is it likely? I doubt it.
Alon Pincus is a retired Israeli diplomat and a former advisor to Israeli prime ministers. He was speaking to us from Washington. Alon, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
In the UK, the Conservative Party has been in charge for 13 years now, but the opposition Labour Party sees an opening, and it might be calling on one of its most successful leaders ever for help. 70-year-old Tony Blair served as British Prime Minister for 3 consecutive terms. His legacy is complicated, though, to say the least. When he left office in 2007, his popularity among the British public and within his own party had plummeted. Since then, the Labour Party has kept Tony Blair at arm's length. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, that seems to be changing.
Tony Blair won a landslide election victory in 1997. That night, Labour Party lawmakers and supporters were filmed dancing, a bit awkwardly, at a celebration party. That song, Things Can Only Get Better, was the anthem of the new Labour Party's campaign. And the next morning, outside his new home at 10 Downing Street, Blair said he would deliver on that promise.
Today, we are charged with the deep responsibility of government. Today, enough of talking. It is time now to do.
Over the next decade, Tony Blair won three successive elections. He helped negotiate the Good Friday Agreement, bringing relative peace to Northern Ireland, and he introduced a national minimum wage across Britain. But on the 20th of March in 2003, Blair made this announcement.
On Tuesday night, I gave the order for British forces to take part in military action in Iraq. Tonight, British servicemen and women are engaged from air, land and sea. Their mission? To remove Saddam Hussein from power and disarm Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction.
That decision divided Britain and his own political party. And by 2007, Tony Blair was out of office. But while his political career in the UK appeared to be over, Blair began to carve out a role for himself on the international stage. He was appointed a special peace envoy to the Middle East, and he toured the world making speeches, charging hundreds of thousands of dollars a pop. In 2016, an official inquiry into Britain's role in the Iraq War concluded that Tony Blair had deliberately exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein's regime. Blair said at the time he took responsibility for his government's actions.
The decision to go to war in Iraq and to remove Saddam Hussein from power in a coalition of over 40 countries led by the United States of America was the hardest, most momentous, most agonising decision I took in my 10 years as British Prime Minister. For that decision today, I accept full responsibility, without exception and without excuse.
But Blair also said he believed it was the right decision. Today, the British Labour Party is led by Keir Starmer, and he's kept his distance from Tony Blair, at least publicly. Although political experts say there's no doubt the pair are in touch.
I think it's definitely the case that Keir Starmer has talked to Tony Blair and continues to talk to Tony Blair, not least because Blair is the most successful Labour leader of all time and therefore surely has quite a lot to teach any Labour leader hoping to win an election.
That's Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University in London. In July, Blair and Starmer actually appeared on stage together. It was the first time a Labour Party leader stepped into the spotlight with Tony Blair since he left office, and Blair was full of praise for his successor.
You know, you've done an amazing job. You've taken the Labour Party in 2019. It was on the brink of extinction, frankly. And you've taken it. I know you can't say it's on the brink of government, but I think it's a pretty good prospect.
Keir Starmer had only positive things to say to Blair too. Since then, speculation has been rife that Tony Blair could be planning some sort of political comeback, or at least preparing to play a key role in Labour's election campaign ahead of next year's expected general election. Tim Bale says that would not be a good idea.
It would be unwise, I think, to discount Blair's influence completely, but I think it would be equally unwise to think that putting him front and centre in any election campaign would be a good idea for the Labour Party.
Blair is still too divisive a figure among Labour voters, Bale says. Scott Lucas at the University of Birmingham agrees.
Blair is, I think, forever tainted because of the Iraq War. That simply shattered his legacy. And there's no way, I think, for many people who are really involved in politics and who are of an older generation, that they're going to forgive him for that.
Lucas is an emeritus professor of international politics. In the last few years, Tony Blair has expanded his think tank called the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. It operates in 35 countries and employs around 800 people worldwide. Its mission is to work with political leaders to drive change. Scott Lucas says Blair's networking ability could be useful to the Labour Party.
Tony Blair has a role here as a veteran politician behind the curtain, right? That for all that we sort of highlight with Blair as a public persona, it's really behind the curtain in terms of his contacts, in terms of his own political advice, where I think he is significant for Labour.
Lucas says Tony Blair might very well be taking on a bigger role with the Labour Party away from the spotlight. But a public role to frontline politics, that's very unlikely. For The World,
I'm Orla Barry.
It's back to school season in many parts of the world. New classmates, new teachers, and for some students, new names and pronouns. There's a wide range of policies on whether educators are required to respect those changes. The World's Bianca Hillier joins me now to talk about this. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Carol.
So there are many different ways schools approach a student who's changing their name or pronouns. Listeners might be familiar with this conversation in the U.S., but it's happening around the world, too. Bianca, give me some examples of those policies.
I've spoken with some teachers who say their policies really allow students to take the lead. So at the beginning of the school year, students could get a piece of paper with two sets of questions. First, what name and pronouns should we use for you in school? And second, what name and pronouns should we use for you when speaking with your parents?
And tell us why those schools think that's a necessary distinction.
It's because some people don't feel safe using their preferred name and pronouns at home. In the U.S., according to the Trevor Project, less than 40% of LGBTQ youth say they live in an LGBTQ-affirming home. So for the majority of students, being outed could pose a real safety threat. So schools are being proactive about that. But on the other hand, we're seeing a growing trend of policies in multiple countries that put the power in the parents' hands.
So what do those policies look like?
It varies from place to place, but basically these new policies are mandating that the parents are involved. So if a student does change their name or pronouns at school, teachers are required to tell the parents about that. And the teacher can then only use the new name and pronouns if the parent signs off on it.
So give me a sense of where those policies are popping up around the world.
UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been promising national guidance on this for months. It hasn't come out yet, but he and other top officials have suggested that schools will be required to tell parents about any name or pronoun changes. And most recently, throughout the province of Saskatchewan in Canada, students under the age of 16 now need permission from their parent or guardian to change their name or pronouns at school.
Okay, so let's zoom in on Saskatchewan for a minute. What led to their new policy?
The province's Ministry for Education declined an interview request, but in a statement they said that over the summer they heard from people who were concerned about how these things were handled in schools. And the ministry says parents make key decisions about their children's upbringing, so they need to know what's going on with their child in school. So these new policies are a way for them to, quote, protect parental rights, as then-Minister of Education Dustin Duncan said in a press conference.
We want the school to be a safe and welcoming environment for all of our students, but we don't want to do that at the detriment of causing a separation between a parent and their child.
Now, Bianca, you mentioned earlier, though, that many LGBTQ youth don't feel comfortable or safe to share parts of their identity with their parents. What does the Ministry of Education of Saskatchewan have to say about that?
The ministry acknowledges that getting permission to use a new name or pronouns could sometimes result in physical, mental, or emotional harm to the student. In those cases, they say they will direct students to a school professional for support, but they haven't detailed how that would work.
So what's been the reaction in Saskatchewan to these new policies?
Many groups have come out condemning the policies, including the Saskatchewan Teachers Federation, the School Boards Association, and the Assembly of First Nations. And I spoke with Brendan Dickey about this. He's a high school teacher in Regina, Saskatchewan. He says he was blindsided by the new policies and gets anxious even thinking about having to implement them.
I would have, extreme difficulty implementing the policy, but I'd like to think that since our code of ethics mandates that we are looking out for the safety of our students, that my not following it wouldn't be a punishable thing.
And Carol, the Ministry of Education has been vague on if that would be a punishable offense, with officials just saying that they do expect teachers to follow the policies.
Is the Ministry of Education in Saskatchewan, is it listening to this response? Is there any indication that they'll rethink it?
Well, they're being forced to listen to it because it's already landed in the courts. The University of Regina Pride Center for Sexuality and Gender Diversity filed a lawsuit against the provincial government. They say the policy violates Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and court arguments for that case began yesterday.
The World's Bianca Hillier has been filling us in on new policies at schools regarding names and pronouns. Bianca, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Carol.
This week, as leaders gathered at the United Nations in New York, a report from the UN called on countries responsible for the transatlantic slave trade to compensate for those wrongs. But there's no consensus on how to do it. Still, Judge Patrick Johnson of the International Court of Justice told a British news channel that all countries must make the effort.
We need to get the former slaveholding countries to meet with the victim states, and it's not beyond us. We need the political will to achieve the solution.
Efforts have been made by some countries on a smaller scale. In Canada, during World War II, 22,000 Japanese Canadians were stripped of their property and sent to internment camps. Redress came 44 years later, setting a precedent for other groups. But as Jimmy Thompson reports from Vancouver, much of what was lost is gone forever.
Art Mickey grew up on a modest berry farm outside Vancouver. Until 1942, that is, when his family was forcibly relocated 1,400 miles away to Manitoba, leaving their farm behind. Mickey is 86 today, but he was 5 years old when he was taken away, along with his parents, who, like him, were Canadian-born citizens.
In the last 20 years, I've gone back to that farm several times. We went there the first time my mother was still living, and we looked at the house that we lived in on the farm. We got there, it was all boarded up. It was being taken over by a huge development. That whole area is being developed.
Today, the little riverside community of Haney is a suburb of Vancouver, one of the most expensive cities in the world. Houses on a quarter of an acre routinely sell for more than $1 million. But in the 1940s, Mickey's 14-acre family farm was sold by the government for $2,000 Canadian. They were one family among thousands for whom the seizure of properties cost them the chance to build generational wealth. Jordan Stanger-Ross is an historian at the University of Victoria, and he has studied this precise question. What did families like Mickey's miss out on?
Those properties increased, some of them as much as 70-fold in value between the 1940s and the 1970s. And so even if Japanese Canadians had retained only one small parcel within the larger farms that they owned, they would have inherited many times more what they actually received.
Canada relocated and incarcerated more than 22,000 Japanese Canadians. Others were exiled to Japan, including some who had never set foot there before. There had been a thriving Japanese-Canadian community in downtown Vancouver. It was emptied out.
And so a neighborhood is erased. There's a remarkable institution, the Vancouver Japanese Language School, that persisted.
The school is still operating today. It even offers walking tours of the neighborhood, which is now a rundown semi-industrial part of East Vancouver.
So here I have a map showing some of the Japanese-owned businesses that were in this area.
The government seized the properties when it interned the owners and told them their properties would be held in trust. But the government soon changed its mind and put them up for sale.
So you can see there were a couple of hotels, as well as a holding house, so a fish cake store, and a design studio.
Mickey's family was working on someone else's beet farm outside Winnipeg, Manitoba, when their own farm was sold out from under them. So that's where he grew up, Winnipeg. He went on to become a teacher and to lead the National Association of Japanese Canadians as they pursued reparations for the harm his community had suffered at the hands of the government. The government's first offer, a $12 million community fund. Take it or leave it. Mickey walked away from the table.
We decided to make it a Canadian human rights issue, and we invited other Canadians to come and support us.
They gained the support of other Canadians, politicians, authors, academics, unions, churches, civil liberties organizations, but they couldn't prove what had been lost.
They wanted some type of quantifiable number as to what our community lost. And, you know, we couldn't answer that question. We didn't have the data.
Accounting firm Price Waterhouse, which itself had been involved in the dispossession, agreed to take the analysis on.
That was useful, I think, in the negotiation with the federal government, and until very recently was the only effort that we had to really provide a comprehensive account of the economic losses.
The accountants calculated the change in value of property during the internment period, but they couldn't really account for the loss of that generational wealth.
They still don't own their home. They still don't own their farm. They haven't gotten their boat back. Their automobiles and their personal possessions have not been returned.
The Price Waterhouse analysis was critical, though, in convincing the media and eventually politicians that there was a real economic loss, one that could be proven and written down. With the newspapers and other civil actors lined up behind them, the Japanese Canadians won the first apology the Canadian government had ever issued to a mistreated group. Each survivor received $21,000, and a $12 million community fund was established.
In hindsight, we likely could have done a lot better. But at that time, there was no case in Canadian law that compensated a whole group of people.
This agreement set the precedent for other groups in Canada who had suffered harm. Chinese Canadians subjected to a racist immigration tax, LGBTQ people who had been harmed by government policy, and Indigenous people who had gone through Canada's genocidal Indian residential school system. Joy Kagawa was in Parliament the day reparations were announced. She grew up interned in Alberta, far from her Vancouver home, and she later wrote a nationally beloved novel about the internment, Aubusson. New Democratic Party leader Ed Broadbent read from the book in Parliament the day the government apologized.
I cannot bear the memory. There are some nightmares from which there is no waking.
I was up in the galleries, and I looked down, and I saw him, and I was just thunderstruck, you know, that he was doing this. I was really so awed and surprised, and it still fills me with the feeling of wonder that this happened.
Up here. Okay, yeah, don't hide in the back.
Today, Kagawa's childhood home in Vancouver has been preserved as a space for writers.
I'm Anne-Marie Metten, and I'm a co-founder of this home for writers.
Other spaces, like the Japanese Language School or the Nikkei National Museum, are direct beneficiaries of the fund. They're places for learning, for art, and for understanding. For The World, I'm Jimmy Thompson in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Today's story is part of our ongoing look at how reparations are being dealt with across the globe. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.